For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Massini. My guest is Stephen Jenkinson, activist, teacher, author, farmer, and host of the Nights of Grief and Mystery Tour, a musical, poetic, ceremonial evening which he describes as a night devoted to the ragged mysteries of being human. The tour will be in Spokane on Wednesday, November 13th at the Bing Crosby Theater. And Jenkinson joined me via phone to talk about his work and the upcoming performance. I want to talk about your show, of course, A Night of Grief and Mystery, but I first kind of want to set up who you are and how we got to this point, because you have such a fascinating story. You have master's degrees in theological studies and social work and worked for many years in palliative care in the healthcare setting, and then founded the Orphan Wisdom School. And so your career has been primarily in the death trade, as you like to say in your interviews and such. So where did the idea come for a sort of theatrical show? How does that fit into your work?
Well, I could start by saying that the time in the death trade was not my idea. I wasn't there involuntarily, but I didn't know such a thing existed, frankly. And I had to be talked into it, if you will, by somebody who knew more about me than I apparently did at the time, myself. And I'm glad I listened to her. I mean, it was in every way majestic and heartbreaking and burdensome and privileged all at the same time. And when you watch how people are in the name of being helpful, you know, you are by turns either astonished or brought to the edge of dementia almost by what you see in front of you. Because the things that masquerade as love and you know, positive regard and even professional discipline, they all stagger and fall by the kind of the strange machinations of dying. Even though dying has got to be one of the more predictable aspects of life, you have to admit. But everyone came to it, and by everyone, I do mean everyone came to it in a kind of low-grade shock. And the alternative was to make it, of course, as normal as possible. But the thing is, that even though it's pervasive in the culture, it's not pervasive in your life. I mean, your death happens exactly once, unless you're a New Age person and blessed with, you know, lifestyle opportunities. But for the rest of us, you get one shot at it, and you witness this as kind of a helpful outsider, which, you know, on a good day, that's what I was. And there's something about the sheer drama of it, I could say, that lend itself so perfectly and so almost as an imperative to translate what I saw into something that could be available to people without need of a terminal diagnosis to get them there. That was probably the genesis of Nights of Grief and Mystery as much as any other single thing was.
And it really is kind of a difficult show to sort of describe what it is. So I thought I might just play a short clip of the trailer, the video trailer, so that listeners can get sort of the sound of what the evening is like. So I'm just going to press play here.
It's the strangest thing. They granted me a visa and fully documented me in order to perform cognitive dissonance on the general public.
Welcome, friends.
It should change everything.
If dying doesn't change everything,
of course, welcome to the catastrophe.
You can lose track of whether you are or not.
So, that's what I understand Nights of Grief and Mystery to be. Cognitive dissonance for everyone.
I'm gonna take a little walk.
This thing that started as an experiment
through them fields
settled into something deep and trustworthy.
Oh, carry me gently.
And the other thing that looms so large suddenly is their face in the pillow. It looks like the moon, and he said, in a field of white, after a long pause, in just this voice, he said, am I dying?
There's a mournful little event that happens in the life of a young boy.
That's the god of death coming to town, it seems to me. So confusing.
That was a clip from the video trailer for A Night of Grief and Mystery, hosted by my guest, Stephen Jenkinson. which will be in Spokane November 13th at the Bing Crosby Theater. So tell me about your musical collaborator, Gregory Hoskins, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
So how does the music fit into the night of grief and mystery?
You know, when Gregory and I began to imagine this kind of collaboration, we didn't really see in any obvious way a link between what I had been doing for years and what he'd been doing for years. Largely because they weren't dependent one upon the other. They happened upon each other and found their web of relation by showing up in the same place at the same time, basically on a tour that we did of Australia and New Zealand, where we were literally trying to find our way. So the beautiful thing about it is that his lyrics and music are, after the fact, clearly illustrative of the stories that I'm telling. And by turns, the stories that I'm telling anticipate some of the themes that have concerned him for years in his own musical work. So who could ever imagine an arrangement like that that would work apparently seamlessly, where people routinely believe that we've crafted something in response to what the other guy has done. And in fact, these things all existed independently before we met. And we discovered the link rather than established and forged it.
So how much of the show is sort of scripted in that way of like, you're going to play this piece of music while I do this spoken word or read this segment, and how much of it is sort of improvisational?
Well, I would say that we don't know what's going to happen. You have an allegation called a set list, and you have a sense of a sequence, because what you're doing is you're building an evening. And the evening is a very uncommon one, because it's not there to dissuade, distract, entertain, or throw people off the scent of what it means to be alive in a strange and in many ways tragic time, the time that we find ourselves in. So it's an attempt to visit upon us all the opportunity to show up as genuine grown-ups in a time that seduces us away from all of that. You know, the Greeks gave us, God bless them, our understanding of theater. And the two things that they lent to us across the Western world by which we've established our theatrical traditions are, one, an audience, which hasn't always been there. And two, a script or a kind of determination of the outcome. And I think what happened there was the Greeks took their understanding of ritual and basically decommissioned it, you know, withdrew from it the volatile possibilities and inserted instead something that could be relied upon to affirm their principles or their ways of life instead of challenging them, which is fundamentally what a ritual does. I think what we're doing is probably ritualistic and ceremonial.
Well, I love that you brought up ritual and ceremony, because I first encountered your work years ago when you were interviewed for The Sun magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And I went back and reread it for this interview. And I remember being struck then and again reading it when you talk about how one thing that our sort of North American culture is lacking is initiation rituals, and that the act of sort of losing your childhood and becoming an adult could potentially be something that would help us better understand or prepare for our own death.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say that this performance, this evening, A Night of Grief and Mystery, do you see it as that kind of ritual or ceremony or somehow related?
Yeah, I think they're related, but I should say that the theme or the focus of the evening is certainly not dying per se. Dying is one of the visitations of limit or frailty that together make up and give us our capacity to find our way towards being a human being. I think it's well named. We call it Nights of Grief and Mystery. And these things aren't exclusively a consequence of dying, not by any stretch. The beautiful thing about being mystified by life is the more you learn about its mysteries, the more mysterious it becomes, not the more available it becomes. And you become a more capable participant in those mysteries instead of their master. And I think that's what we are on the stage. We're this mystery's servants for the evening. And if we get out of the way properly, which is what any initiation ceremony properly does, is it gets the intention of the participants out of the way and allows in or even pleads for some kind of fundamental challenge to the status quo. And our status quo, the one we're taking on, is only nominally, you know, personal and intrapsychic and individual. Largely, I think what we're taking on is the prevailing madnesses of the time that have led us, by many people's understanding, to a kind of cliff edge of what's doable and what's survivable. And so we don't leave that out. And that's why I say really what the theme is limits and frailties. And dying, of course, is one of those things. But our unsustainable way of life is another one. And there's at least a handful more.
I'm talking with Stephen Jenkinson, activist, teacher, author, farmer, and host of the Nights of Grief and Mystery Tour, which will be stopping in Spokane on November 13th at the Bing Crosby Theater. Talking about mysteries of many kinds and death being one of them, one of the huge parts of the fear and anxiety that people have, both about their own death and sort of the future of our culture or our ecosystem or however you might spin that, is that they don't know what happens. We don't know what happens when we die. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. And the way that many people reckon with that is through spirituality or religion. So I'm curious, do you ascribe to any particular tradition, or do you believe in an afterlife, or do you think that that really matters when talking about some of these big mysteries?
Well, first of all, everything matters. That's the first thing to establish, I think. That everything is consequential. Human beings are agents of consequence in this world, first and foremost, right? Second thing is, most people's beliefs, they cobble together during the course of their life as a kind of antidote to or firewall against, you know, devastating frailty and undoing. So it's ironic that we develop a system of beliefs to guard us against what's coming anyway. And then when it comes, our beliefs are almost singularly inadequate to enable us to undertake the work that the ending of days pleads for. So in my particular case, I haven't met a religious tradition or spiritual tradition that would have me. See, in all honesty, I think that's probably the case. And so whatever I have is instead of what's available, you know, in the marketplace of beliefs and ideas. And I was just very lucky, you know. I was in on a lot of other people's death way before my own comes around. And that's its own tempering, I guess. And I suppose I was tempered. And my good fortune was I didn't go into the work in my 20s or my 30s. I was in my mid to late 40s when I started. And I thank God for that, because it is deeply undoing in the short term to be in the presence of a fellow human's, you know, ending of days, and you so deeply limited in how you can be useful to people when the lion's share of their life was lived as if such a day was never coming. So that's the irony of beliefs, say, that they don't really assist you if the beliefs are not derived from the realities of the episode of life that you're asking them to be useful to you in.
So how much of, do you think, our inability as a culture to deal with or reckon with our own eventual death comes or is exacerbated by our healthcare system? And you're Canadian, so it's a little different. Do they have a better idea of end of life up there than we do here in the States?
Well, you know, as an outsider, I'm not sure that I'd qualified to observe it, but just as a fellow human who's been lucky enough to travel in your country a lot, I would say that the differences are considerable, actually. They're not minor. For example, the degree of cynicism around the healthcare system that plagues your country is not here in this country. And it doesn't make us better people. It makes us fortunate, I think. And the sense, you know, the deep unwillingness to believe in its machinery by virtue of the profit aspect of the thing and the private insurance aspect of the thing and, you know, your government's continuing inability to gather itself around the notion that being taken care of by the culture that you were trying to take care of through your whole working life is not communism. You know, it's sanity. So we're lucky that we have a different understanding of our responsibilities to each other when one of us goes down. And, you know, we have other problems equally as undoing, perhaps, as yours.
Sure.
But I think the healthcare system in general, in your country and mine, probably lags behind the realities of life. It is a kind of, properly understood, dying is not fundamentally a medical event requiring all kinds of massive technological interventions.
Yeah.
What dying is a whole person event that has some physical aspect to it. Mm. But when you have a healthcare system that's predicated on disease management, then you're going to come to dying as another disease to manage. And when the whole repertoire of management goes bankrupt and becomes unuseful, nobody's willing to look at each other and say, well, I guess this doesn't apply here. And it's sad to see how deeply unwilling the master practitioners of the art form are to acknowledging the limits of what they're capable of.
Well, getting back to your night of grief and mystery that's coming to town, and back to your life as a younger man, so an interesting sort of footnote that I think is really fascinating in your biography is that when you were a much younger man, you sort of picked up a harmonica and ended up performing and traveling with Dr. Hugh Morgan Hill, better known as Brother Blue, who's
right.
Sort of this larger-than-life performer, preacher, character who traveled around doing these performances. So did that experience help shape your idea of a night of grief and mystery, or talk about that time?
Man, it was never to be duplicated, and I'm certainly not duplicating it at this point in my life, that's for sure. I could tell you that I was his apprentice, although nobody ever declared it. But I'm not sure it's not clear to me to this day what I was apprentice in. What I was able to do was be radiated by his example. I mean, it's kind of an aggressive way of understanding it, but that's certainly what happened. His example was relentless and merciless, which is to say that he burned so incandescently that you were exposed to what an adamant and unapologetic human being is capable of in the time that is allotted to them, period. So here's what happened. This guy turned into a thief, and he stole from me something I didn't know I had. And then when I realized that he had stolen it, I still didn't have it, but for different reasons. And what did he take? He took from me the ability to be miserably moderate in my orientation to my own life, and it's slings and arrows. And he stole from me my ability to proceed as if I'd never seen the real thing. But I had seen the real thing, you see. And what it did was held me to a standard which could, from the outside, look almost diabolical because it's so relentless. And something of that survives into this time of my life, and I'm awful lucky it does. Because people say to me, how do you maintain this pace? And, you know, people your age are supposed to be cooling out, and and you got a rock band. And how does that work? And the answer is, well, you know, when I was much younger, I saw what age devoted to its time looks like. And, you know, that will always be with me. And I'm a very lucky guy that my options are so reduced. I could either be absolutely abandoning the example that was held out to me when I was young, or I can pick it up one more time and see if I can translate it into the time that I am aging into. See? So that's my great, burdensome good fortune.
Well, my guest has been Stephen Jenkinson. He will be in Spokane hosting a night of grief and mystery on November 13th 7 p.m. at the Bing Crosby Theater. Stephen, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, it was a very generous invitation. I appreciate it, too.